You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. If you're a creative person, you must be right-brained, right? Wrong, according to a growing body of scientific research.
But why is that? Our next guest explains why the right-brain-left-brain arguments, first of all, caught on in the public, and how scientific myths like this tend to stick.
Maggie Ryan Sanford joins us. She's a science writer devoted to promoting scientific literacy. She wrote an article called Art and the Right Brain Fallacy, and she joins us now from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio to talk about it. Maggie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
So tell us about the origins of this right brain creative, left brain logical idea that we have and how it got started.
Right. So this all started back in the 90s with a study that Dr. Gazzagna did. He is a psychologist and biopsychologist, to be fair. And he was working with a patient named Joe who had had his corpus callosum severed, so because he was an epileptic, severe epileptic. And this procedure helps calm seizures because it kind of disrupts the electric storms, they call them, that happen between the two hemispheres. So Dr. Gazzagna took this opportunity to kind of see what was going on with the two hemispheres of his brain, what would happen if they weren't communicating with each other, and found that there were some functions that didn't translate from one hemisphere to the other. And then kind of rounded up and said, well, you know, we know that the right hemisphere kind of recognizes the whole picture, like sees a face in a group of objects, whereas the left hemisphere will find specifics, knows the words for things, and kind of pulls details out of chaos. And then kind of, like I said, rounded up and decided that this meant that the right and left hemispheres overall had strengths and weaknesses, which immediately the popular culture kind of latched onto because, in my theory, people like to know about themselves. They kind of like to hear, hey, you know, I'm more of a kind of calculating, unemotional, mathematical mind, and so I must have a stronger left hemisphere. This was perpetuated by self-help books and kind of know yourself, get to use your strengths kind of culture that happened afterward. And it's kind of stuck around.
Well, we want to dig a little more into how that spread and how it caught on. But first of all, what's some of the research that's been done since then? I mean, is it really not true that we have this stark division of labor between the sides of our brains?
Definitely we don't have a stark division of labor because if we did, we probably wouldn't get that much done. More and more research is showing that almost every function, you know, when you think about a function that you're doing in your everyday life, it's a little bit different than what we mean when we say, when we refer to a brain function. A brain function can be something very specific, one specific neural communication at a synapse level. And when you're thinking about functions that you do in your everyday life, you're thinking about, you know, going to the store and everything that's required in that, getting in your car and driving and deciding what you need and all of those processes. In order to carry out any real world action, you need to have all of these neural pathways firing. And the recent study that kind of came out and brought this conversation about the left brain, right brain fallacy, some people are calling it, back into the scientific conversation, basically asked that specific question, looked at 1,011 different individuals from ages 7 to 29, and compared their brain activity at the very micro level, looking at they divided the brain into 7,000 regions and looked at the connections between those regions because more and more we're realizing that anytime you want to get some answers out of what the brain is doing, it's more about the connectivity than it is about the pinpointed neurons, basically. And found that when there were more connections in one area of the one hemisphere of the brain, it was more about where those connections originated. So basically, if a person, one of the subjects that they were looking at the brain scan, if they had more going on in one hemisphere of the brain, it was probably because of a particular thought process that was happening at that moment, not about what was happening in their brain overall.
I have to admit, this is interesting to hear because this is something that, you know, I've heard and sort of it took to be truth for a long time. And in fact, there's a book called The Master and the Emissary by Ian McGilchrist from not too long ago. It was incredibly popular and influential. I know, you know, some artists locally who are reading it and trying to connect with their right brain. And this is from just a year or two ago. And he's a pretty influential guy. And as I understand it, his work is getting a lot of attention in circles that study consciousness. So is there still some controversy about this?
Absolutely. I mean, nobody likes to hear that the myth or the information that they've perpetuated in their work isn't true by other people. But that's true in every area of science. There are going to be different schools of thought and skeptics no matter what. But the best way that I can think to describe it is that the study that Dr. Gazzagna did was a psychological study. It wasn't a neurological study. The newer study that we have at the University of Ohio is, or Utah, excuse me, that was a neurological study looking at actual brain scans. Dr. Gazzagna was looking at behavior, and the two things are very different. In terms of the right brain, left brain idea applied to your own life and kind of labeling yourself as one or the other, I think that's still really useful. And even some of the people working on the study said as much. They said, you know, it's still possible if you look at the literature, they're saying, you know, use that idea of the left brain, right brain in terms of deciding what your strengths and weaknesses are. Absolutely. Just don't think of it as your brain is firing more on one side or the other, partially because I think that limits your idea of what you're capable of. If you think of yourself as somebody who is more emotional, more creative, you tend in on a neurological level, if that were the case, then you might give up on kind of trying to become more mathematical and analytical on that level. And I think that's what you're saying about the master and the emissary is anybody can learn to exercise the parts of their brain that aren't necessarily what they're born with. You know, you can undertake activities that reinforce neural connections that then change your mental strength, so to speak.
Part of what we want to talk about is how this idea caught on and other scientific ideas like that. And I think what's appealing to me is it takes this incredibly complicated thing, the brain, and gives it a nice, easy metaphor that we can work with. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's part of the appeal?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the brain, as you're hearing in this conversation, is so incredibly complicated. And I often think about it in the same terms as studying the universe and the laws of physics in the universe where we're not able to look at them. You know, the brain is right there in our heads all the time, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we're able to see what's going on, first of all, and then understand what we're seeing, even when we are able to use something like an fMRI to see where blood is flowing and which parts of the brain are activated. It doesn't necessarily give us all the answers that we want to. And everybody likes to think that they can understand themselves. I think it's a natural human inclination to want to identify what's going on with yourself. It gives you a sense of power. It gives you a sense of self, basically. And I think that's exactly why this particular idea has been so prevalent.
One of the things you try to do as a science writer is to promote scientific literacy. And I wonder how people feel, what kind of response you get about this research and what the researchers themselves have gotten. Do you feel at all like you're trying to bust up a party where everyone's having a good time and then you have to come in and say, no, guys, it's a lot harder than that?
Oh, gosh, no. I'm not of that school of thought. Some people certainly are. There are some members of the scientific communication community and members of the scientific community that take a little bit of delight when they get to come in and say, no, actually, you're all wrong and you've all been hyped up and you drank the Kool-Aid. But no, I'm more after what can work. You know, the reason that this idea of the right brain, left brain dichotomy perpetuated is because we didn't really have the whole story. And I think rather than coming in and being like, no, you're wrong, you know, you're looking at it in a way that's unscientific, why not say we can participate in this scientific conversation as lay people, as people who aren't necessarily neurologists or psychologists. Let's get all of the information and then decide. And that can be a lot of fun. That's kind of where I'm coming from.
So one question I wanted to get to, and we'll take a break in a moment and invite some callers, it seems like there's a fundamental challenge in science writing. We're storytelling creatures. We like to learn things in terms of stories, on the one hand. Science doesn't always break down into a story or a narrative. Sometimes it's a big cluster of data that we have to try to interpret. How hard is it to bridge that gap?
It can be pretty hard. Sometimes you have these great narratives that emerge from scientific research. I'm trying to think of some off the top of my head. You know, the story about the apple falling out of the tree and hitting Sir Isaac Newton on the head, that didn't actually happen, but he does have a really interesting life story that you can call upon when you're talking about the way that he found what he found, the way that he was doing his research, and how it related to his everyday life. Sometimes that's not the case. And yet, science is still carried out by human beings. You know, scientists are human beings that have lives and life stories, and whether they would like it or not, emotions and interests and histories. And I think for me, I'm interested in looking at those histories, getting to know scientists as human beings and seeing how that influences their work. The challenge there is how do you respect their scientific authority, and every scientist wants to seem as unbiased as possible, and once you start getting into the personal stuff, that becomes more difficult. So I think that the challenge that I have is getting to know scientists, letting them talk freely as human beings, and still understanding that the science that they're doing is as scientific as possible to the best of their ability.
We're talking right now with science writer Maggie Ryan Sanford about the myth that certain things like our creativity or our ability to analyze are controlled by only one side of the brain at a time, the left or the right.
You can join in at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. A couple questions for you. Even if the left brain, right brain thing isn't true, do you think it's useful? Do you think it helps you in your life? Do you have a place you go to for great science reporting? What makes good science reporting and good myth busting like this? 800-642-1234. Send an email, talk@WPR.org.
And you can also post on our Facebook page. It's Central Time on WPR. We'll check the headlines, and then we'll be back with Maggie right after this. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're talking about scientific fallacies right now. The idea maybe that people are left-brained or right-brained. Why certain myths initially based on science catch on easily while others might not.
And why do you think that is? What more could scientists and science journalists do to make science easier to understand? Are you attached to the left brain, right brain idea that's been around for so long? Is it going to be hard to let go of? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or share your ideas on the Central Time Facebook page.
Our guest is Maggie Ryan Sanford, science writer. We'll go to the phones now. We have Amy with us in Waukesha. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
What did you want to share with us?
I have a almost 12-year-old daughter who excels in reading, has had some challenges with math, has always been a little bit on the klutzy side, and recently, within the last year, we did a visual test that led to an MRI, an emergency MRI, and learned that she's missing approximately 25% of the tissue in her left brain due to some cysts that have been there apparently since birth, and we
Wow.
had no idea. And so there are some things that her right brain wasn't able to accommodate for, such as vision on the right side of both of her eyes. So amazingly, she accommodated for that as well, because nobody has ever noticed that she wasn't seeing, and she couldn't tell us that she wasn't seeing because this is what she's seen for her whole life. But in all other regards, she has excelled academically. We really just didn't know, and so it's really amazing to us that her right brain and what was left of her left brain could accommodate to this degree.
Amy, thank you so much for sharing that story. Maggie, I guess one of the lessons here, and a lot of the research you're talking about, the brain is flexible if it can accommodate for that kind of gap.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things that I think is so fascinating and so cool about the brain is we used to think that you had a certain amount of brain tissue, a certain amount of brain cells, and they were finite. You know, they didn't regenerate. And if you lost them, then you're kind of out of luck. But more recently, we've learned that that's not the case. The brain, like the other cells in the body, can regenerate. And I'm so happy to hear about Amy's daughter. It's, you know, just a testament to, I think, the fact that if you kind of take it for granted that you can learn certain things, you're going to learn them regardless of, you know, what your limitations are. And that sounds kind of like happy-go-lucky and rah, 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 the world is perfect. I'm sure that she's had some troubles, as we've heard. But I would be curious, in fact, to learn if the correlation between her reading and math strengths had much to do with the left brain problem. It's possible that she would be a more literary person anyway.
Well, thank you so much for that call. And let's move on to Julie joining us from Madison. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
What do you
think?
Can
you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
I recently, it's been circulating on Facebook, is this spinning lady. And she goes one direction, actually clockwise, if you are right-brained, and left brain, counterclockwise, if you are left-brained. And everybody I know who is extremely, considers themselves creative and right-brained, she goes clockwise. And the people that are stereotypically, that I know, left-brained, she goes counterclockwise. A couple people I know, she can switch back and forth, but it seems very predictive.
Interesting. And Maggie, what do you think when you hear that? Obviously,
right,
it's
that
appealing.
Exactly. It is appealing. I can't speak to the spinning lady in particular. I haven't seen it. And also, I'm not a neurologist, so I can't for sure speak to that phenomenon. I am reminded, though, of a study that Dr. Gazzagna himself did, where you, I think, have heard about the idea that left-handed people are more right-brained. They tend to be more right-brained. If indeed we were going back to this idea of left or right brain dominance. So Dr. Gazzagna himself was interested in perpetuating that idea. The word dominance is really kind of the arguable word there. But even in his own research, he did some studies on left-handed people and found that 40% of the time they were right brain dominant, according to his metrics, and 40% of the time they were left brain dominant, and the other 20% of the time they could do both, kind of like you're describing with the spinning lady. So I don't know how that necessarily correlates with the identity that people are pulling from the idea of their right brain or left brained. Not being a neurologist, I would guess that there is probably some power of suggestion there, perhaps, that if you identify as one, then you're going to expect one result. But I certainly can't speak to the spinning lady on any scientific level.
thanks for the call, Julie.
And,
thanks, Julie.
You know, it's interesting, too, that, you know, this is a cool theory. You can see why it caught on. You know, Rob was talking about the simplicity. It's sort of elegant in the way it helps you understand things. On the other hand, we had the caller was talking about the way her daughter's brain had compensated for missing tissue. And what's really seems to be emerging a lot is sort of the plasticity of the brain and the fact that the brain can compensate and create workarounds and can come back from a stroke and things like that. And in a way, you know, if you're going to have a brain, which we do, wouldn't you rather have a brain that's more flexible and plastic and can solve problems, you know, from both hemispheres than just having this sort of dogmatic left brain, right brain thing.
Right, exactly. And I actually wanted to say to Amy that she should feel encouraged, feel free to encourage her daughter to continue working on that math part. Just because she's struggling with it right now doesn't mean that has to stay that way. And she knows that better than most people. I have a friend who always considered herself a right-brained person. And as she went through her life, she had some medical trouble and finally decided that she wanted to become a doctor, despite the fact that her entire life, all of this left brain, right brain evidence had told her that wasn't going to be her forte. And lo and behold, she's studying really hard. It's probably a little more difficult for her being creatively inclined as opposed to analytically inclined. But she's doing it. And as she goes along, she's noticing that it gets easier for her. And I think that you can see a little bit of that brain plasticity in practice.
Maggie, earlier you mentioned some of the amazing imaging we can do of brains now and see what lights up when. But it seems like there's almost a cottage industry of people explaining human behavior, because this part of the brain lights up when you see a green cereal box, but that brain lights up when you eat shrimp. Do you think people are reading too much into these scans, or is there really promise there?
You made up the shrimp study,
I
Rob.
Did.
Never heard of it.
Is that a Repo Man reference? Plate of shrimp.
Oh, maybe. Accidentally. Wait, let's see where my brain is lighting up when I say that, if it's in the Repo
right,
Man
exactly.
zone.
Right, exactly. The Repo Man region is lighting up. What was the question? Right, the cottage industry. I think any time that a new technology comes out and seems to have a bunch of answers that we didn't have before, it's very exciting. And people necessarily want to cash in on that. I think that, first of all, I'll just say that plenty of the neuroimaging that's happening out there is done by scientists who know what they're doing and will collect the results and analyze them appropriately. But I think when you get excited about a technology like that, it can make you forget about all of the other resources that you have at your disposal. And for instance, I was speaking to Dr. Lori Marino, who is a dolphin researcher specializing in the brain. And she's one of the pioneers of trying to neuroimage dolphins and has learned a lot. You know, a lot of the research that she has become famous for has to do with that. And yet where she's thinking that she wants to go in the future, kind of to get more answers about cognition, is looking at the evolution of the brain and going out into the field and watching the behaviors that are actually happening, for the very reason that just because blood flows to a certain area of the brain, it doesn't tell you everything that you want to know.
And we're going to have to leave it there, Maggie. I'm sorry, we're out of time, and appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it, too.
That was Maggie Ryan Sanford, a science writer devoted to promoting scientific literacy.
Coming up in the wake of Monday's mass shooting at the Washington Naval Yard, we'll talk with a psychologist about how we react to such events and what motivates the people who perpetrate them. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.